If it's local and it matters, it's Above the Fold with Steve Stewart on Real Talk 93.3.
Welcome to Above the Fold here on Real Talk 93.3. It's Thursday, day after National Signing Day for football, which I think means nothing now, because I think you could have a different team even after the signing in like 2 months based on the new rules. But anyway, there's a show on after this that we'll get into that. We're going to focus on our expertise, which is local government and things going around the community. Got a good show for you today. Thanks for tuning in as we getting close to finishing out the year here, 2021. Kids finishing up at school, going to be home. You know, I miss those. Is it, you know, when I think of the holidays, I think of these half days that we used to have with kids at school. I mean, it was during Thanksgiving week. You had to go Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday, but you just were there for like 2 or 3 hours. Now they just give you all the days off. And so anyway, we're getting into that time of the year here with Christmas, with students finishing up final exams in high school and I guess even middle school. And then they'll be at home. So we're getting into that part of the year. Want to talk about, in our next segment, we'll talk about the local election scene. We've been doing that a little bit more frequently because things are heating up. And we've got a new entry into a race that we'll briefly discuss. Someone I know, so I didn't have to do a lot of research. But that's on the Leon County Commission side. So we'll give you some info on that. And we'll talk about this Bellamy-Matlow race in terms of the money being raised. And, you know, this is, again, as I've said before, I think is really good for the community because it will be able to flush out some issues. And with the money that's raised, they'll be on both sides. It will be a contested race. So, you know, we'll talk a little bit about that because what happens is you start asking questions, they start putting out positions, and you can start evaluating people. And the thing is, too, sometimes there is nuance in positions, and that's up for the media in interviews and obviously in writing articles to try to ascertain exactly, you know, what the position of someone is. And, you know, we're going to talk about that here in this segment. So, you know, the FSU vote, the $20 million is going to become a big issue from a political standpoint. Are you for it or against it? And seldom are things that, you know, that simple in terms of just saying I'm for it or against it. Usually there are nuances, and we'll talk about that. The bottom of the hour, we're going to talk about this report. I don't think I spent enough time. I don't even know if I brought it up. A little bit confused with the holiday season here. The Anatomy of a Homicide put out by Sheriff Walt McNeil. There's a story now in the Tallahassee Democrat, which I think is going to, you know, it's going to raise a lot of questions. The title, the title is Black Teens Point to Poverty as Cause of Tallahassee Gun Violence. Now, when you read that they interviewed 12 black teens and they put a statement like that on the story, and you read through the story, you can see that it's 12 black teens, but this is putting, you know, a causal effect between poverty and Tallahassee gun violence based on the opinion of 12 black teens when you have, you know, 30 to 40,000 kids in Leon County. I think reaching that conclusion in a title like this is very misleading. And the reason why I bring up the Anatomy of a Homicide report by Sheriff Walt McNeil is because a lot of what they are addressing in this article is based on the findings in that report. So we're going to go over these findings. And look, to argue that if you're poor, there's a higher chance of having gun violence. Obviously, poverty can be a contributing factor, but I think to put that as a cause is you're really pushing an agenda. And so we'll go back and look at this report because it was very detailed and there's a lot of different contributing factors. But I think there are people that live in poverty that don't have to deal with gun violence. And so maybe there are some other factors involved. There's a lot to untangle with that. So maybe this will just be a start and we'll continue to talk about it. Because I think, you know, one thing about this report that Walt McNeil did, 93 pages, you know, you can pluck things out of there and support a narrative. But if you look at it holistically and you're intellectually honest about what's going on, I mean, I think you can list a bunch of contributing factors, but to say that poverty is a cause of gun violence, what resulted in poverty? Are there some areas that live in poverty that don't have gun violence or don't have murders? Well, there are. I mean, in Leon County, there's zip codes that have the exact poverty rates as other zip codes and have much less violence. So that right off the bat would say there's got to be something else at work other than poverty. So we'll get into that. It's the bottom of the hour. At the end of the show, the last segment, we'll touch on state issues as we usually do. Some big issues. Nikki Fried is accused Governor Ron DeSantis as accepting or basically extorting money from people for positions on university boards. Even the mainstream media is really questioning that charge. And, you know, it's starting to look like Fried is getting desperate as she has to defend herself with an ethics complaint. She's had previous issues. And so now this last one, someone called one of the biggest unforced error she's made so far. So anyway, we'll talk about that. Governor DeSantis has put forward some anti-woke legislation. I'm not real crazy about this. And I'll tell you why. First, we'll tell you what it's about, and then we'll tell you why it's, you know, reeks of pretty clear partisanship. But anyway, we'll talk about why he thinks we need it and touch on a couple other issues. Before we get out of here in this segment, and we'll talk about the politics after a break, wanted to just one more time highlight the nuances, and I'm using that word too much, so I won't use it anymore. Looking at the specifics of the FSU vote on the $20 million, I've been spending a lot of time going back and reading the minutes of the Blueprint IA meetings over the last 6 months. And as I said, when you say if you're for or against it, you know, we're going to have an article up in a few days. It'll be in our newspaper, which is coming out this week, that really looks like it looks at each of the votes. There were three elected officials that voted for the FAMU grant and the TCC grant and voted against FSU. And those three people are Leon County Commissioner Rick Miner, City Commissioner Jack Porter, and City Commissioner Jeremy Matlow. So if you know the other seven that voted for it, it was a 7-5 vote. They voted for all three of the grants to go to all three of the institutions, TCC, FAMU, and FSU. Now you say, well, how about that 7 plus 3 is 10? How about the other two? Well, it gets complicated. Christian Dozier was the only one to vote against the FAMU grant and the FSU grant. So she was consistent in not wanting any of the stadiums getting economic development money. And then there's Brian Welch. He was not in office, and so he didn't vote on the FAMU project. However, he did finally vote against the FSU project, but that doesn't mean he was against it. And you say, well, Steve, how do you know that? Because I read the minutes. He supported a motion to give $15 million, not $20 million, to FSU. His argument was he wanted to hold back $5 million for future economic development opportunities. So to say that Brian Welch was against the FSU project, when you read the minutes, shows you where he really was. And I think it's important to note those. So you're up to date on that. When we get back, we'll talk about local races, a new entrant in the Leon County Commission race, and we'll just tell you who that is. So stay tuned. I'm Steve Stewart. You're listening to Above the Fold.
If it's local and it matters, it's Above the Fold with Steve Stewart on Real Talk 93.3.
All right, welcome back to Above the Fold here on Real Talk 93.3. Appreciate you joining in. We'll talk politics, candidate races, money. The money's starting to pile in here in these races. I'm looking at the Leon County Supervisor Elections website. You do a really good job of tracking all of this. But before I leave the FSU $20 million vote, you ask, well, you know, why is this going to be so political? You know, a couple of examples of why. First of all, Leon County Commissioner Rick Miner, who originally voted in September when you had a standalone vote for the $20 million, voted for the project, the FSU project. He changed his mind when it came time to issue the bond finance vote. And he said he changed it because he started getting so many phone calls from constituents. What's interesting, and I never did go back and look at the total on Twitter when he announced that he had changed his mind. It was just the opposite. There was over 100, I know, responses that were just very negative about him changing his mind on it. So navigating this from a political standpoint, now he's not up for election next year. Well, no, he is actually. Scratch that. He is up for election. He has two opponents. So that will be, I'm sure, will be an issue. And so we'll see what happens there. The other thing is there is a candidate that we've talked about here before, Adner Marcelin, who was running against Diane Williams-Cox, who has said, hey, this is the issue that made him get involved in running against Diane Williams-Cox. But, and this is the thing I want to point out here. So Diane Williams-Cox voted for the $20 million, but she also voted for the motion, which failed, to give $15 million to FSU and keep $5 million in the bank for future economic development projects, which I think would have gone a long way in really releasing the political pressure on this issue. But having said that, she's got a pretty defensive posture here on the vote. Because as I said, only three people completely voted against the FSU and then voted for FAMU, and that was Matlow, Porter, and Rick Miner. So those are the that's why I think it's going to be an issue. Also, as a reporter, you know, we talk to candidates from time to time off the record, and they're wanting to know where their opponents are on this issue. So transitioning to looking at the Bellamy Matlow race again, we looked at if you look at the amount of money that was reported, and we've talked about this, $103,000 by David Bellamy and $56,000 for Jeremy Matlow to this point in the race. And, you know, Bellamy's average contribution is about $700, where I think Matlow's is $150. So definitely more donations for Matlow, who's been in the race longer, but bigger donors for Bellamy. Now, you know, you start to see the context of this race developing, as we've talked about. You've got, you know, Matlow, who is, you know, is going to be running as the outsider candidate running against the Tallahassee Chamber of Commerce, quote, candidate, or running against, you know, the moneyed interest developers who get subsidies from the city. And so that's going to be his shtick. And that's what he said after, you know, after Bellamy came out with this money, is like, look, you know, he's got a bunch of $1,000 donors. These are the people that we want to get away from. They're just donating because they have interest in the political system. And so that is where he's going to come from. Now, the other part of this on Bellamy is, you know, he's made the comments that, look, rhetoric, you can't take rhetoric to the grocery store. And that, you know, the issue there is he's arguing that Matlow is just basically throwing a lot of darts and not getting things done. So that'll be an argument that will be put out in front of the voters. Now, listen, you know, these are supposed to be nonpartisan races, but at this point, the way things work is just not that way. Everybody knows, you know, what party they're in. And these are both Democrats. So Bellamy is a Democrat, and so is Matlow. So now it's going to be, again, we've talked about this in the past. This is going to be what type of Democrat do you want? I think Matlow is clearly more progressive. I would say that Bellamy is more of a moderate Democrat. I think probably more comparable to Curtis Richardson, Diane Williams-Cox. You know, I'm not sure about Mayor Daley in terms of being moderate. I know he's very moderate on economic growth issues, but he's taken some very liberal and progressive positions on some social issues. So, but anyway, so that's how that race is gonna shape up. And I think from a money standpoint, boy, I think everybody, it's almost like a horse race where you see more people gambling on a horse race. You want to get into it because it's going to be so exciting. I think you're going to see more people putting more money in here, and it'll be instructive to see who starts spending money first. Obviously, Matlow has huge name ID from being in office, and that comes with being an incumbent. Mr. Bellamy, though, the thing I will tell you about him, and sometimes this is underappreciated, I mean, being raised here in Tallahassee, I know that the city has grown a lot, but his mother was on the city commission, was mayor. He's a doctor, got a lot of patients. And so, you know, he may not have the political PR that Matlow has gotten from being an incumbent, but, you know, he's been around. And so obviously his ability to raise money is an indication of that. We'll see if he's able to continue to raise money. I think for him now, it's not going to be about the amount. It's going to be more about how many donors he can actually get. And so we'll keep an eye on that. Now, the other races, not a lot of changes to report, except for the Leon County Commission District 5 race, which we've profiled a little bit here. This is the seat that is being vacated by Leon County Commissioner Christian Dozier. There are five people now filed to run. The most recent one is Jay Revel, and he's someone I've known for probably 10 years or so. He was an aide to Mayor John Daley at one point on the Leon County Commission side, and he was also a vice president with the Greater Tallahassee Chamber of Commerce. So he will be labeled a chamber member, which is the way things are sort of moving here in local politics. That is becoming, instead of being labeled a Republican or conservative, now the labels are, you know, you are a chamber member or a developer. But anyway, so he was a vice president of the Greater Tallahassee Chamber of Commerce. I know he grew up in Gadsden County, I believe. And now he has his own consulting company. And he, you know, again, would categorize him as moderate. I don't know his political affiliation. But now in that race, it's getting to the point now where you got five people. You got David T. Hawkins, who has got $10,000 in the bank. Dustin Revis, who is another person who's very active in the Greater Tallahassee Chamber of Commerce. And then two people that I'm not familiar with, I'm going to have to get caught up on, Paula DeBoles Johnson and Jerome Kalub Fitz-Connor. That might be the name of the election season there. But anyway, this race is going to take a little while to develop, because one of the things that when you have an incumbent step down, and I've been involved with one of these races, it is you get a lot of people in the race because there's a vacuum. The incumbent who's got all the name ID is leaving, and so everybody thinks this is an opportunity, and it is. But the problem is a lot of people see it that way. And so we've got five in now, and so, you know, trying to have a debate with five people, and again, I'm speaking from experience, is painful. And you always are trying to separate yourself out. And it's just, it's very difficult. So just imagine if two more people get in this race, you're going to have seven people. So then it does really become a race for money, and trying to see if you can get onto that specific issue, that soundbite that gets you separated out. But I suspect that Mr. Revel and Mr. Revis will definitely be able to raise enough money to, you know, to get their message out. Not sure about the other three people. We'll have to keep an eye on that. Again, this is a district race, so you don't have to have a lot of votes. It's not like you got to canvass all over Leon County. So this is something that can be, you know, a candidate that has a good grassroots movement can really have an impact in a race like this. So the other races, not a lot of changes in it yet. I know that, again, I think looking at the minor race will be something I'll spend some time over the holidays with two opponents. One has raised $6,000, but I think Leon County Commissioner Minor is going to have to sort of navigate this FSU vote, and it's going to be, you know, it'll be a numbers game. I mean, District 3 is a downtown district, but it also goes all the way out past I-10, so a little bit demographically diverse. We'll see if that vote causes him any pain. So, electoral pain, that is. Anyway, I'm Steve Stewart. You're listening to Above the Fold. We'll be right back after this break.
If it's local and it matters, it's Above the Fold with Steve Stewart on Real Talk 93.3.
All right, welcome back to Above the Fold. As I said, thanks for tuning in. We are going to dig into this Anatomy of a Homicide report. Wanted to share some numbers with you. And the reason I'm going to do this is because of the Tallahassee Democrat, which is the Gannett on paper here in town, is taking this report and going out and you know, listen, the approach and methodology I don't disagree with. I think, and looking at this, you want to try to dive into some things and see if you can put some context and, you know, figure out exactly what the report is saying and then connect it to the community and how you change things. But as we know now with the media, there's always a narrative and always something that's pushing. And the title that caught me was that basically they're saying they've interviewed 12 black teenagers and they put on the front of the story that the cause of gun violence is poverty. And now look, being an engineer and someone who is looks at numbers, using the word cause is, you know, it looks like an innocent word in the English language, but you're talking about a direct relation, a cause. And there's very seldom things in this world that are caused by one thing. There's many other contributing factors. And to limit it and to include that as the cause, especially based on an interview with 12 people in a county that has 300,000 people, you know, you start to wonder exactly what, you know, why you would do that. The report now, if you look at the report that Walt McNeil put out, and I have applauded him for doing so, it's 93 pages. So when you know, he didn't do a report that said poverty is causing crime. He did a report and looked at all the contributing factors and didn't, you know, he listed, look, these are our findings. He didn't single out one of them to say that, you know, look, this is the cause. He's saying, look, there's a number of things that are contributing to this. Now, and you know, and I may be biased here, but I think that there's this move because we hear this with a lot of nonprofits who cite this number of a third of Leon County's children are going to bed hungry at night. And, you know, there is, I'm not going to minimize the issue of poverty where it exists, but I think our definition of poverty, you know, has been something that has been expanded, and I've read up on this. And it's complicated, but I will tell you my reading of this and the way some of these people use these numbers, that a third of the kids in Leon County are not going to bed hungry at night. That is just, there's not a stat that will show that. So are they food challenged, which means that you may miss a meal once every month? Possibly, but it, again, so to single out poverty as the driver here, I think that, you know, there's a lot of money in trying to get people fed. And so anyway, that's another topic. But what I wanted to do is take that idea that you can take gun violence or, you know, the number of murders in Leon County and say that poverty is driving this. So I want to go through some of the things that Walt McNeil and his employees found in this comprehensive study. First of all, they looked at murders over 5 years. There's 103 of them. And the thing that they reported, the overall finding, was that 75% of the victims in those 103 murders were African-American, and 69% of the offenders were African-American. So this clearly, they indicate that this is a... you know, it's an African-American issue in African-American neighborhoods. The average age of the victims was 29.6. The average age of the offender was 28. The percentage of people, of the victims that had a criminal record is 52%. So half the people that were murdered had a previous criminal record, which again would indicate that you're probably not hanging out with some of the more upstanding citizens in Leon County. And there are some, there are a number that you can hang out with, but the offenders, 84% of the offenders had a criminal record. And again, you know, this may not be surprising. Now, where did these take place? 73% of the homicides took place in three zip codes, 04, 01, and 10. So it's 32304, 32301, and 32310. 91% of the homicides took place in five zip codes that have 57% of the population. And that would be 01, 03, 04, 05, and 32310. So 32304 had the highest number of homicides, I think, out of the 103, which was 36. And so, and obviously that is one of the poorest zip codes in the state of Florida. Hence the title, Poverty Drives Driving This Gun Violence. Now, before I came in here to the show today, I did take a gander at some other numbers. But, you know, 32305 is a zip code which is on the southeast part of Leon County. It's had about the same poverty level as one of the zip codes that had a double-digit level of murders, which they did not have. And, you know, one of the defining factors of the demographics there that were different was family structure. Now, this is something that's not addressed in the article that looks at poverty, but it was addressed in the report put out by Walt McNeil. And it looks at the family structures in these zip codes, absent fathers, looks at the number of people, looks at the childhood impacts of growing up in certain neighborhoods. So again, the report is comprehensive. We did a report on this just showing the findings, but to try to draw conclusions and to pick one causal factor out, I think what it does is it really looks like you have an agenda instead of laying out other options. And so, you know, I think what we'll do is start to try to get into this and look at the different factors that are involved, because again, it is not one factor. And to argue that just because you're poor, that you're going to be, there aren't families that work hard, make the right decisions, that they are going to be, you know, somehow connected to more gun violence or violent crime. I think there are other factors that should be considered, or at least should be addressed. Now, if you look at this from a public policy standpoint, and again, Walt McNeil did not list one, he didn't list one solution. He listed a number of things that needed to be done. And again, you know, if you look at what some of the programs he's instituted, it involves looking at the family structure. But I think, you know, you look at the Children's Services Council that is, moving along in its development, is going to be getting some significant money. I think, you know, they're going to be doing a needs assessment. And I can just see now someone standing up and saying that poverty is, you know, is causing gun violence and murders, and we need more money, you know, to get food into these houses. And I think, you know, one of the issues here is that this is why the needs assessment with the Children's Services Council is so important, is that, you know, I hope we find something that actually can move the needle and that is maybe a little bit unique in what other areas are doing. Because, you know, what we want to do is find something that works, that we can invest money in on the ground level and try to have a difference. Now, one of the things that I think is important to understand is that a lot of this stuff takes it takes time. I mean, if you start looking at, if you assume that, one of the findings in this report was that I think half of the offenders had been arrested before the age of 12. So the question would be, you know, you've got to get started early, and you're not going to see the results until years later. And, you know, I think this is all going to sort of wrap around to what's going on in Title I schools. And the thing that I think we fail at a lot of times is people think that money is always the answer. And really, it's not. It's about where you spend the money. And I see this idea that we need to spend more money on poverty, where I think that what the Children's Services Council and our leaders need to look at is we need to look at what causes poverty and not trying to, you know, just to spend the money alleviating it. We got to look at alleviate the cause. And look, there's a lot of, you know, very complicated studies that look at this, and there's some simple ones. You know, graduate, you know, don't have a kid before you get married, and get a job are three things that if you do, I think the stat is like 95% of the people that follow those three steps aren't in poverty. And I mean that, you know, that, golly, just saying those things make me think of how simple that can be. But again, that's from my perspective. There are people that are faced with other challenges. So, but anyway, we'll spend some more time talking about that in the coming months, I'm sure. All right, when we get back, we're going to pivot to some state issues, and we've got a couple of good ones to talk about. So stay tuned. I'm Steve Stewart. You're listening to Above the Fold.
If it's local and it matters, it's Above the Fold with Steve Stewart on Real Talk 93.3.
All right, welcome back to Above the Fold. You know, the breaks sometimes don't do me good because I get to read my Twitter feed. And so, look, this story in the Tallahassee Democrat is going to be is going to give me heartburn for over the holidays. And we're going to continue to address this. But one of the reporters that wrote that is, look, we have become journalism has become about advocacy. Her Twitter feed sounds like a campaign commercial for Jeremy Matlow. There's two Tallahassees. You know, there's one where there's no money for food and no opportunities. This is a freaking reporter. After interviewing 12 teenagers, I mean, it boggles my mind. It's disappointing, frustrating. And anyway, we'll deal with it when we get back next year, because this stuff is printed. It won't go away. And you know what? I don't, for the life of me, don't understand why people love reporters on Twitter, because they write stories and then they just exactly tell you how they feel, and you can exactly see that. But anyway, all right, I promise you we pivot to some state issues, and we've got a couple of good ones. So the Governor Ron DeSantis made some big news signing the Stop Woke Act. You know, this is getting a little bit too cute, you know. Stands for Stop the Wrongs to Our Kids and Employees Act. Says DeSantis banned critical race theory from Florida schools, he said his next step in legislation is to fight back against woke indoctrination. Says in Florida, we are taking a stand against the state-sanctioned racism that is critical race theory. We don't allow Florida tax dollars to be spent teaching kids to hate our country. And says here, according to some of the information released, the state's breaking down the legislation's intentions and provisions. The Stop Woke Act will provide a framework for Florida schools and businesses along with penalties. So for Florida businesses, the plan intends to protect employees against a hostile work environment due to critical race theory training. As a result of violations of the bill, employees, parents, and students will be insured a private right of action. That means a lawsuit. As well as enhancing the authority of the Florida Department of Education. Now, the problem here is obviously this is political red meat for the right. But the other thing is going against some of, like, Republicans, conservatives don't like legal, they don't like lawsuits. And this is what this is doing. They're trying, you know, they did this in Texas with the abortion issue. And so now it's like, we're going to take everything to court. So look, I think there's, you know, is this where we are now? Is there not more things that we could do from a legislative standpoint, from, you know, a reasonable standpoint than to get to this point? You really are on a slippery slope. You're starting to tell private businesses, you know, what they can do. I mean, for so long, Republicans were about loose regulation in regards to businesses. This has been an issue. No doubt about it. Now, I'm not saying that there are not, there are not problems to be addressed. But if you look here just in Leon County, there was legislation that put an end to the vaccine mandate at Leon County government. You didn't have to force people to sue And that has been now worked out. But I'm not sure that this is really a good idea. This makes me think a lot of the House Bill 1 on the, what they call it, the Anti-Riot Act, which turned out to be, from my standpoint, you know, a little bit of a very quick feedback when, you know, we had people that were conservative for the most part blocking roads and weren't arrested, and that was part of the new bill. So it makes you, when you do these things that are political, they do come back to haunt you. Will this be the case? You know, the one thing on the, and I think I understand why they're doing this, is because, look, there is a lot of wokeness out there, and it, but, you know, in the private sector, there's not as many tools to deal with it. I mean, there's these woke moves in the school system, which I think we can address by appointments, by legislation, but to get the, you know, the, to offer up remedies that involve more lawsuits, you know, I'm just not sure if that's the right answer from a practical standpoint. Politically, I'm sure it's a winning hand for Governor DeSantis. The second issue I wanted to, the next issue I wanted to talk about was, you know, Nikki Fried is getting desperate. We've talked about the campaign numbers in terms of raising money. Just not a real good picture for her on that side, even within her own, the Democratic primary compared to Charlie Crist. But, you know, this comes on the heels of the issue with the ethics complaint and her having problems filling out the financial disclosure forms, not once, not twice, but looking at three or four times. And now she's going to have to deal with the same ethics commission that Andrew Gillum did. And usually there's a settlement, you pay a fine, but you're basically, you know, that becomes a media hit for a while. And the ethics complaint here, you know, it's not just any ethics complaint. This is one that now has been deemed to have probable cause, which is a big hurdle. And so that puts it into an administrative process, which just gets all tangled up. And that's why I say, you know, you have to settle that to get it out of the news, and it becomes an issue from here on out. Now, her latest thing is to, she's accused Florida Governor Ron DeSantis of requiring prospective University Board of Trustee members to donate $100,000 to a campaign. In turn, he would grant appointments to university boards. Now, that's just a pure pay-to-play accusation. And, you know, even moderate journalists, or if you want to call them journalists, mainstream writers are saying, you know, this is just, you know, over the top, even for Fried. Florida Politics publisher and writer Peter Shore said, quote, "This is one of the worst unforced errors to date for a campaign that is already on the ropes." That sums it up pretty good. And so the point on this is, you know, you are basically criticizing, or you're accusing a sitting governor of something you can put in jail for. And so, you know, this is, again, what happens when you get extreme, when you try to go emotional, you say things like this. Is she doing this because she's so far behind, or is she doing this because this is what she truly believes? Either way, it's really not good. And you remember, this was the gubernatorial candidate was doing a press conference every day talking about these COVID cases. And then all of a sudden the COVID cases started going down. She quit doing the press conference. So she really looks, she's starting to look like a character, like just not, she wants to be governor because she just wants, because she doesn't like Governor DeSantis. She doesn't really have a mission other than to legalize marijuana. And now a lot of people are saying, is that really the only reason she's running? And then that brings back the whole thing on the financial disclosures, because she has a lot of financial ties to the marijuana industry. So, you know, it's going to be interesting to see how she does against Charlie Crist. But this latest cocktail, Molotov cocktail she's thrown into the ring is not scoring her any points. And so we'll have to see what the outcome of this is. And if, you know, again, when you're accusing someone of bribery, like, here, I'm going to give you $100,000. You give me $100,000, I put you on a position. And the media is saying, look, there's no proof. The Fried campaign is saying this, and they are offering no proof other than showing, you know, some donations from people that are on boards. And that's, look, I think if you go back and look, at Charlie Crist when he was governor. He probably got donations from people that was on that were on boards. But to, again, to make this a causal thing and call it a pay-to-play is could be a bridge too far for Nikki Fried and have a negative impact on her campaign. All right, thanks for joining me today. Have a great afternoon, and I think we will be back for one last show on Tuesday before the holidays. So tune in then. But until then, enjoy the Jeff Cameron Show and have a great afternoon.